If you pay attention to the signs and signals that the universe sends you on your path that are meant to direct you in a certain way, believe, have faith that if you follow that path, it will take you somewhere good. And even going bankrupt, having my company, fail in 2008, even that was a gift. And the second thing, besides, being physically strong, that I want to share with people as a piece of advice is that I've gone through life believing that everything is a gift. Everything is a gift. Growing up in the bush turned out to be a gift. Losing my company in 2008 became a gift because now I live on a lake surrounded by cedar trees, and I'm working in my studio, and I'm still doing what I love. So losing my company was a gift because I would have been in worse shape if I'd clung on to it and not listened to what the universe was telling me. So everything in life, in business, is a gift. If you have that belief, then you will find that no matter what happens, you can survive it, you can thrive, and be happy.
Welcome to Chase Your Dreams, a podcast for fashion entrepreneurs who want to build a purposeful and profitable clothing business so they can make a living doing what they love. I'm your host, Glynis Tao, an apparel business consultant and SEO specialist with 20 years apparel industry experience. I'm also a mom to a wonderfully energetic little boy named Chase. Hey everyone, I'm so thrilled to have you join us today as we delve into the incredible journey of Canadian fashion designer Linda Lundstrom. Linda Lundstrom is an award-winning fashion designer, lean manufacturing practitioner, inspirational speaker, Indigenous ally, and creative director of online outerwear brand Thermakota. Linda's career spans over 5 decades in the fashion industry. She's well known for designing and building the Linda Lundstrom brand and a state-of-the-art Canadian lean manufacturing facility. She is the recipient of numerous awards, including 3 honorary PhDs. She was named to the Order of Ontario in 1995 and the Queen Elizabeth II Diamond Jubilee Medal in 2013. She is recognized as a champion of First Nations awareness and ethical manufacturing practices, a proud supporter of the Made in Canada label. Linda's entrepreneurial journey is marked by synchronicity, guided by mantras from her parents, and a deep commitment to social responsibility. Today, Linda shares her insights on embracing change, the impact of technology in manufacturing, and why challenges should be seen as gifts. Join us for an inspiring conversation with a true fashion innovator, Linda Lundstrom. Hi, Linda. It's so nice to have you here today. Thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you, Glynis. It's so good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
You are a Canadian fashion industry icon, and I'm so honored to have you here sharing your story and expertise with us today.
My pleasure.
So can you tell our listeners a bit about yourself and how you first got started in the fashion industry?
Wow. How much time do we have? Well, the short story is that I started sewing when I was 3. The fact that I did what I did with my career kind of makes sense when you know that. We grew up in a little tiny community in northwestern Ontario. It was a mining community, gold mining community, where there was a lot of little towns, each one with a gold mine. And so the town that we were in when I was actually a hamlet had about 11 houses. And my mom ordered a Singer featherweight sewing machine from Eaton's catalog. It was electric, which was state of the art back then, because a lot of the sewing machines were treadle sewing machines. You pump them with your feet. So my mom had this little sewing machine, which was her pride and joy. And she took the needle out and let me play with it. Can you believe it? So at the age of 3, I was doing a feeding fabric through the machine, but there was no needle in it. And then she thought, oh, this kid seems to be pretty competent. And that's so she put a thread in it and a needle and gave me fabric. And So by the time I was in grade one, I was making my own clothes to go to school.
Wow.
Yeah. And my mom, so my mom was really instrumental in encouraging. I mean, can you imagine? We're in the middle of nowhere in the bush. Our only contact with the outside world is Eaton's catalog. Or one of our only contacts, wasn't the only one. There was a highway out of the area, which is basically, it's called the Red Lake District, but it was made up of these little towns. And we lived in several of them, but the one I was born in was very small. And so for her to supply me with fabric, sometimes it was just the bags that flour came. Flour used to come in cloth bags, by the way, so did sugar. And so my mom saved those bags and she'd let me experiment with them. So when I got to grade one, I was wearing my own clothes and I wasn't wearing like little girls' things. I was wearing like pencil skirts with a slit up the back.
But you were already a fashionista then.
I was making adult clothes, but in miniature sizes. And so that was how my career began. And then I just, you know, school was something that I had to contend with when all I really wanted to do was go home and sew. Mm-hmm. And so consequently, my scholastic records were not great. I did graduate from high school, but I graduated with a 53% average. So I had some subjects that I was pretty good in, like English and anything creative, but not so good in math and those kinds of subjects. And so my options were limited, but we sent a submission to Sheridan College with photographs of all the things that I had made from the time I was that high to my, you know, to my 17 or 18 year old self. We sent the photographs to Sheridan College and I was accepted. And that's where I met my tribe. I met other people like me who were making things and who had shown this ability. And so I was, you know, died and gone to heaven. I mean, that's where I really thrived. And I was getting A pluses on my projects and high marks. And it was the first time I'd ever experienced that.
Yeah, that sounds very similar to my story as well. Like I was really not very interested in things in high school except for home economics and sewing classes, the sewing classes
exactly.
That I took.
Yes. Yeah. Home economics was a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it wasn't until I went to fashion school too that, you know, I felt like I came alive.
Which school did you go to?
I went to Kwantlen. BC, and then I moved out to Toronto and went to Ryerson University.
Okay. Yes. So, and did you study fashion design or fashion merchandising?
A fashion design.
Okay. Oh, cool. That's really interesting.
Yeah. So then after Sheridan, then did you decide to start your own fashion brand then or?
No. I knew that I got a certain amount of knowledge from my time at Sheridan College, but I knew that it was more of an academic approach, and that to really understand, you know, manufacturing and the business, the industry, I needed some practical experience. So I said, okay, I think I was 20 when I graduated from Sheridan College, and I thought, okay, I need to get some experience in the industry. So I thought, okay, and when I'm 27, I'm going to start. So I'm going to take the next, you know, six or so years, and I'm just going to learn more. So I worked for a couturier in Toronto. Then I worked on Spadina Avenue as a pattern maker. And that was really wonderful. It was a company that had been in business for a long time, and they took me under their wing, and they really enjoyed, you know, teaching me how it actually worked in the industry, you know, like going to New York and getting patterns because they had a tie up in New York. So they didn't actually create a lot of their own styles, which is something I didn't realize, that the Canadian industry was basically based on copying or having a tie up with a company in New York that was creating the styles and the patterns and then reproducing them here. I also worked, I also worked for a company in London, England, called Frank Usher, because I was awarded a Canadian government scholarship to study abroad for a year. And so I went to London, and I was accepted with Frank Usher as an intern. And I worked with them for 8 months. And then I went to the south of France, and I worked for a company called Shacock. So you can imagine my learning curve was just, you know, it was going way up.
Yeah.
And I came back just full of enthusiasm and thinking, okay, I need another couple of years on Spadina Avenue learning more. And I could not get a job, couldn't get a job. And so that's when I decided to accelerate my plans by a couple of years and start my own company. So call my mom and dad, said, Mom, Dad, remember when you promised me that when I was ready to start my company that you'd loan me some money to start it? Well, I'm ready now. And so they did. They kept their promise, because my dad was in the mining business, but after being an underground miner for many years, he started his own company in the mining contracting business. And my mom had her own company in our basement where she sold fabric and rented sewing machines. So that's another part of my story, is that when I was about 10 years old or 11 years old, my mom opened this fabric store in her basement, in our basement. And she bought fabric from Eaton's catalog. And then she sold it for the same price she paid for it. And she made cake and coffee for everyone that came to her fabric store. And so my dad said, Olive, you're losing money. So that's when my mom started traveling to Winnipeg, which is like an 8 hour. Well, it was like a 1.5 hour plane ride, but it was an 8 hour drive. My mom started going to Winnipeg and buying fabric at wholesale so that she could afford to, you know, mark it up a bit and cover her costs. So I would come home every day and go downstairs, and there would be a fabric store in our basement, right? And so my job was to, my mom also rented out sewing machines because she didn't think that not having a sewing machine was an excuse for not buying fabric. So she started renting sewing machines out to people for a month at a time. And when they came back from the person, they usually, the thread was jammed or something. They needed cleaning, they needed oiling. And that was my job. I became like almost like a sewing machine mechanic. So simple repairs to sewing machines was something that I developed, and I love doing that. I love machinery. And so where was I? So I studied in Europe for a year and came back, started my own company in a two-bedroom apartment with a loan from my mom and dad. And that was in 1974.
And that was the start of the Linda Lundstrom brand. Which is,
yes,
so you started out of your parents' home.
No, I was in Toronto at this time. My mom and dad were, I stayed in Toronto because I knew I had to either be in Toronto or Montreal. And I was sort of a flip of the coin, but I was in Toronto one day picking up my things that had been in storage at a friend's, and I ran into one person that I knew, and I thought, okay, I'll stay in Toronto. I know one person here.
Oh,
I didn't know anybody in Montreal.
Right. So
I rented an apartment, a two bedroom apartment. I had sewing machines in one bedroom. Not many, like two sewing machines, industrial sewing machines. In fact, I still have one of the machines. I don't know if you can see this machine right here.
Uh-huh.
This machine is an industrial Singer sewing machine. And when I bought it in 1974, it was old already. And that machine has not missed a stitch in all those years.
Wow.
It's my favorite machine. It's a beauty. It's a beauty.
Yeah.
Yes. And
you're still using it.
Still using it. Had the motor replaced once. You know, maintain it as much as I can because I know about machine maintenance, right? So that's why it's lasted so long. And so I had sewing machines in one room. I had rolling racks in the second bedroom with garments on them and patterns and stuff. My living room was my showroom, and it also had a couch in it that was a hide-a-bed. That was where I slept, but in the daytime it was a showroom. And the dining room was where I built a table, a cutting table. The apartment was one of these old apartments with the dining room was like the largest room in the apartment. And the way I built the table was if I gained weight, I couldn't get out from behind the table because of it fit exactly into that space. And I started showing I made a small collection and I started showing it to people. One thing led to another. It grew very, very slowly. I remember my first year, my sales were $14,000. My second year, they were $30,000. And my third year, I think my sales were over $100,000. And I just kept, you know.
You kept going from there.
Yeah, I just kept going.
Wow. So what was the vision that you had for the brand in the beginning?
You know, the mouse that's in a maze and it just goes where the cheese is.
Yeah.
You know, that whole analogy.
The maze.
Well, the maze and they go for where the cheese is. And so I made my first collection. I made dresses. I made tops. I made sportswear, coordinated sportswear, tops and bottoms, skirts and pants, jackets and blouses. I made coats. I made a lot of different categories. And back then, the industry tended to be in categories. You were either a blouse house or you were a pant house or you were a coat house, or you know what I mean? The industry wasn't set up to be like a concept, a wardrobe concept industry. And I learned pretty quickly that buyers, and I was selling to retail stores, I was trying to sell to retail stores. Buyers were used to categorizing. They went to one place for their blouses. They went to another company for their dresses, another company for their coats. So when I put out this collection that had everything in it, coats and everything, I kind of confused the buyers, I think. And what sold the best was the dresses. Who knew? Mm-hmm. The dresses sold way better than anything else. So I guess that was a sign that maybe there was a void in the dress end of the industry that for some reason I stumbled upon it. And so what happened was the next collection, I made more dresses. And then the next one, I made even more dresses. I dropped the coats. And started going to where the cheese was. And at a certain point, I became sort of known as a dress house, which was okay as I was building my business, but I felt very limited in that category. But I kept going and my sales kept, you know, my sales kept going up. And then an amazing thing happened in 1980, at the age of 30, a very good friend of mine invited me to join her on a trip to Japan. She was in the fabric. She had gone to Sheridan College, but she ended up going into the fabric design end of the business. And at that time, Japan was the main supplier of fabulous fabrics. Today, it's China and Korea, but back then it was Japan. And so to be invited to go with her to Japan was an amazing opportunity. And her name is Glynis, by the way. And that's
your friend's name?
Yeah, my friend's name was Glynis. Yeah, she changed my life. And so I really didn't have a pot to piss in. Like I did. My company was growing, but when you're running a growing company, you're almost always cash poor because you have to finance that growth, right? And you have to buy more fabric to fill more orders and everything. And so we were running a pretty tight ship. And I thought, well, I can't afford to go to Japan. But Glynis said, well, you stay with me in my hotel. My expenses are all paid. You're just tagging along. So I did. And I took her up on it. And I went to Japan and I was mesmerized by the aesthetic in Japan. You know, I thought it was going to be a cesspool of humanity with people pushing you and crowding you. Not at all. People really respect personal space over there. There were lots of areas that were very spacious and the inside of buildings. It just blew my mind. And the fashion back then was being recognized around the world from Issey Miyake. Rei Kawakubo had just started. It was pulsating with creative energy. And I landed right then in Japan and I got to absorb all that. And what I observed was that the Japanese fashion that was really being recognized around the world, like in Europe and everything, was when you looked at it, it was all geometric shapes that were based on the kimono. They were kind of kimono-esque, but then they had taken those geometric shapes and they had morphed them and twisted them and made them into these really unusual things. And they started to rediscover some of the traditional fabrics of Japan that were being used in modern day, but were actually old ancient textile techniques. And so I thought, wow, it's Japan at that point was really leaning into their natural cultural heritage. I came back from that trip and I looked at my collection and I went, no wonder I'm working so hard. I'm trying to figure out what's happening in New York, what's happening in Milan, what's happening in Paris. I'm reading Women's Wear Daily, trying to figure out, how to stay up with everything. And I felt a little bit like this. I went to Japan and I went, stop. I canceled my subscription to Women's Wear Daily. I stopped traveling to all the different shows and everything. And I said, okay, what can I make that is to Canada what the kimono is to Japan? What can I draw upon having grown up in the north in a little tiny town? What was it about that life experience that I can bring into my work now? What is it about, is there a garment? Like, is there a garment that's typically Canadian? And then my father is from north of the Arctic Circle, was born north of the Arctic Circle in Sweden. And his family was partly Sami, which is the indigenous people of northern Sweden. And they were called Laplanders. And so I'm asking myself, what can I make that is a reflection of my Lapland Sami heritage, my Canadian experience living in the north? And at that point, I was visited with a vision that kept recurring. It's almost like a dream that you have over and over and over and over and over again. And the vision, it was of a figure walking across a frozen horizon. There was no trees. The sky met the ground, which was covered with snow, and there was a very faint line where they met. And the sky was shades of pink, soft yellow. And it was, and walking across was this figure with a pointed hood and fur around, walking in profile. And the color of the coat that this person was wearing was the same color as the color of the sky. So you can you see it? Am I painting a good picture?
You are absolutely. I can visualize all of what you're saying.
Was very mystical.
It just seemed like that vision is so clear in your mind. Like,
It's almost as though, Glynis, it came from somewhere in. It's almost like I felt like I was channeling, because it kept coming back, and it always came back in the morning when I was waking up, but I wasn't fully awake yet. This vision would appear of this woman walking across this horizon, and it was all very dreamy, very dreamy. So I went, oh, well, that's a beautiful parka, which I grew up wearing parkas. Like, we all wore parkas. We had our little jackets with the fur around here. And I've got photographs of me when I'm like two wearing a parka that my mom had made. And because it was a good design for the North. And then I thought that my father's heritage was from Lapland, and they dressed in a system of layers also. So The outside layer would be brightly decorated, and then inside they would either have wool or they would have reindeer hide inside. So there'd be layers, the outside one being being decorated with bright ribbons and everything like that. So I went, wow, it's almost like a combination of my lap background and a parka. Maybe I should call it La Parka.
Yeah. And that's how La Parka was born.
Yes. Yes.
Your famous La Parka, right?
Like what started with this vision turned out to be a product that I ended up manifesting. So I had to get I wasn't a coat house. Remember, I had eliminated the coats.
Yeah, and you were into dresses.
I have this obsession based on this vision to make what I see in my vision. And I told two people what I had in mind. One person was my sales agent in Western Canada that I knew that would be a market for this. And that person laughed at me because their idea of a parka was what you see in Eaton's basement, you know, with rickrack around it. And it wasn't considered to be an iconic garment. He laughed at me. So I fired him because I knew that this was had to happen. I thought he was going to be all enthusiastic, and he wasn't. Yeah. I said, okay, fine. Okay. I don't need your energy.
This. Yeah.
Yeah. Get lost.
Like, go away.
And then I told the second person who was my, sort of the person that was helping me run the company, who was a Ryerson graduate. It's now called Metropolitan University, but she went to Ryerson and started with me as an intern and ended up never leaving. And I said, Donna, I've got this idea, and I explained to her my vision. And she said, Linda, I can't see it, but if you can see it, I believe you can make it happen. So I support you. Well, 3 months later, she was killed in a car accident.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. But so I had to postpone everything for a year because she was pivotal to my business, and everything had to be put on hold for a year. Meanwhile, her passing triggered a lot of things to happen. I ended up getting married, getting pregnant. And by the time I was working on La Parka again, I was pregnant. And I had opened up my first Lundstrom brand store, and I started accelerating my plans because I thought life is short. Life is short. I was at the age of 30. I had lost somebody really close to me. And that was a reminder that, you know, if you've got plans, just get them done. So I have this vision, right?
Yeah.
I have this vision. And in case you're noticing, I have two brains. One brain is in here and one brain is in my hands. My hands do things almost on their own. and that's how I built the La Parka. I ended up getting fabric from a supplier that I had never bought from before. It was the wool duffel, getting a machine that I didn't know if it was going to work or not due to the blanket stitching. I went to a show in Paris for fabrics because I wanted to get the fur for around the hood. And I didn't think of using real fur because I hadn't learned how to handle real fur. You know, you need cold storage. I wasn't knowledgeable in real fur. So I thought, I'm going to get a fur fabric. And I went to a fabric show in Paris with hundreds of exhibitors. Like literally, I'm talking 4 football fields full of booths selling fabric. And I went down the first aisle of the first hall. I was about halfway down that aisle and I turned, and there's a company selling the most beautiful fur, man-made fur, in all the colors that I was thinking of doing, like royal blue, red, ivory, all the colors matched exactly. I'd only been at the show for 15 minutes. Yeah. And I went, oh, wow. So I took their card and I said, okay, guys, there's got to be more. If we found these guys this easily, there's got to be more companies that we can go and compare prices and everything. We spent the next 2 days going up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down all the halls. And that was the only company that had fur.
Yeah. It's as if it was meant to be.
Yeah. I mean, if something falls into your lap, what I've learned, if something falls into your lap, it's kind of divine intervention, and pay attention, because when you're making something that came to you in a vision, then you have to be prepared for magic to happen along the journey,
Yeah.
And so when that happened, I went, "Phew, this is amazing."
That just
Right?
confirmed it to you. That said,
It
like,
totally confirmed. And I ended up doing business with that company for the next 25 years.
wow.
Right? So I come back from, I've ordered all this fabric, I've ordered the fur, hasn't arrived yet. I've ordered a machine, I don't know if it's going to work, a blanket stitch machine, not this machine, another machine, a blanket stitch machine that I don't know if it's going to work. I'm up to my maximum at my bank in terms of my line of credit. I can't tell my bank that I've gone out and spent all this money on this vision. Like, what am I going to do? Go to the bank and say, "Yeah, I'm a little over my line of credit because I had a vision." And you know what I mean? Like, they don't want to hear that. They want to hear,
That you're actually doing making sales here.
they want to hear,
They're
they
gonna
want to
see
see
your
cash flow projections.
cash
They want to
flow,
see
yes.
a balance sheet. They want to see all that stuff, which was like, so on one morning when I was on my way to work, we were waiting for everything to arrive, and I was coming down the Don Valley Parkway. I'll never forget it. And there's an overpass right around Richmond, where you can go off onto Richmond. There's an overpass right there. And I all of a sudden was filled with doubt. I went, my inner voice was saying, "What the hell have you done? Does that ever happen to you, Agnes, as Glynis, I'm sorry, Glynis, when you feel like you're taking a risk and then you get filled with doubt?"
Yeah, it just so comes out of nowhere and hits
Comes out
you,
of
but
nowhere, and
it sucks you
it kind
down.
of sinks like
Sucks.
a hot lead
Y
stone right down
yeah.
in there, right? Oh God, what have I done? And so as I was coming up onto from the Don Valley Parkway up onto the Gardiner Expressway, those of you who are in Toronto, you know exactly what I mean. Out of nowhere, in front of me comes this truck. And on the back of the truck is written the words La Parkan. La LAPARKA. So La Parka with an N at the end.
Wow, talk about a sign.
At the very moment when I'm being filled with such doubt.
Doubt. Yes.
Oh my God. And again, I didn't just take it for face value and say, "Oh, it's a sign, I'm on the right track." No, I went, "Damn it, somebody stole my name and they've got trucks out on the road delivering it."
That just increase the doubt more or
Oh,
what?
it increased the doubt, right?
Okay.
And underneath the big logo, big La Parkan, it said, "For all your shipping needs." Oh my God. It was a white truck. I'll never forget it. And so I got into work. We were on Wellington Street back then. And I'm going through the phone. Back then we had phone books. Okay. I'm going through the phone book and I see La Parkan. I dial the number. Someone answers the phone, "La Parkan." I said, "What kind of company is this?" And she said, We ship boxes and barrels to the Caribbean." "Oh, do you make coats?" "No, but we'll ship them to the Caribbean for you." So that was my sign, La Parkan. Isn't that amazing?
Wow, that is an amazing story.
And you know what? I've got the, where's the,
I'm all
I
into this
have
stuff,
a,
this like synchronicities and signs
oh
and
yeah, are you? Okay,
coincidences
I'm
and
just
things.
looking around. I've got the
That is
photograph. Oh, I
Of
should have
the
been
truck?
prepared with the button. Okay, so years later, when we're doing like $10 million of sales of La Parka, and we've moved a couple of times to bigger premises because we're, you know, our sales are going up. The bank is inviting me out for lunch, for God's sakes, putting me in their annual. I'm a success story in terms of the bank, who I never told I was doing this. And we're selling La Parkas like crazy. And I went, you know what? I tell the story of the truck. I need some evidence. So I call up La Parka and they're still in business. I said, I had a friend who was Jamaican. I said, I want to ship a barrel to your family in Jamaica. So I called La Parka and I said, I wanna pick up. I've got a barrel here going to Jamaica. So my friend was thrilled because her family, you know, we put all kinds of fabric in there and we put all kinds of food in there and everything like that. And so the truck arrives and it's not white, it's brown. I said, oh, okay, well, stand on the bumper. I want to take a picture of you. And so I took a picture of myself with this truck with the LaPar can. I said, what happened to the white truck? They said, oh, that broke down years ago. I said, how many trucks did you have on the road? He said, oh, we've only ever had one.
Yeah, and that was the one
That was the
that
one
you saw in
that I
front of
saw, and
you
it was
that
white,
day
and it
when you were
was
all
white, and
filled
it.
with doubt and ready to give up.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And then
That's my.
this appeared, the sign appeared.
Yeah. So, you
That is an
know,
amazing story. But so
yeah,
you've been.
my journey has been a series of magical, synchronistic, divine things that have happened on my path that have directed me, you know, in the way, the path that I'm supposed to take. So after, you know, 34 years in business and being taken to lunch by my bank and receiving a lot of the awards which you mentioned, I've received some. They're up here on my windowsill here now. I've got some wonderful awards where I was recognized for our business practices, for innovation, because we weren't just innovating our product, but we were innovating the way we did business, the way our factory was set up, our employee relationships. For example, we didn't have sick days. We had wellness days, and everybody got wellness days. So if you just didn't feel like coming to work, and you knew that you were not going to feel like coming to work on Friday because maybe your child had a dentist appointment or you had a doctor's, whatever you need to do to be well, you could use those days for that and not feel guilty that you called in, pretended to be sick. How many people have called in, pretended to be sick when they weren't really sick? They just needed a day off.
Yeah.
So in our company, I didn't want anybody to do that, have to do that. I said, you've got wellness days. You use them however you want. You don't have to be sick.
Wow. That's unheard of in the fashion industry, Linda.
Well, that's something, yeah. Well, that's
It's
something that
usually
I
more
just.
cutthroat than that. People just expect you to work.
Yeah, no, because my dad had his own business and my mom had her own business. And my dad's business in particular in the mining business, he always would say to me, Linda, you gotta be good to your men, you know, because it was all men that worked in the mines. And his way of showing that was to, you know, there was a remote mining site where they were working. He would make sure they had steak and roast beef and, you know, had a cook that could bake fresh bread. And the food becomes really important if you're in the bush working long hours in a mine in the cold. Food becomes very important. And he knew that. And so my mom and my dad were my role models, really. And also in my mom's fabric store in the basement, Indigenous women would come from the reserves all around. If you look on a map of where Red Lake is, there's Pecangicum, there's Sandy Lake, there's Deer Lake, there's Great Bear Lake, Great Slate, sorry, Bearskin Lake. All these Indigenous communities would fly into Red Lake and the women would fly in. Then they would take a taxi to my mom's store in Kochener, which is another little town that's, you know, 20 miles from Red Lake. And they would come to my mom's store. And the town that we lived in then was 250 people. So we were moving up, you know, from the first town I told you about. And they would spend hours. And I would be down there, and they didn't speak English. And we didn't speak Anishinaabekwe. But we would spend hours together just feeling fabric and looking at fabric and laughing. And one of the things my mom did was she really honored the beautiful work that the women were doing with home tanned moose hide and deer hide, moccasins, mukluks, gloves, you know, gauntlets. Because we wore mukluks all winter long. We didn't wear boots up there because when it snowed, it didn't melt. It just snowed, and then it snowed some more and more and more and more. And so it was clean. The winter was clean. And so you could walk around in your mukluks, and it was the warmest type of footwear. And curling sweaters. We also curled in these curling sweaters with the, you know, the different reindeer and everything in all in them. That was another thing that I incorporated into my collection. And these women would come to the fabric center, and they would have available really good fabrics to line their mukluks, because what they were doing is they were making beautiful mukluks and moccasins, but then they didn't have lining. So they would take an old shirt or something, and they'd line this beautiful moccasin with it. My mom said, no, here's the fabric you need to line them. So it elevated the perceived value of them. And I can remember going downstairs and the smell of that home tanned moose hide. Have you ever smelled home tanned hide?
No.
Oh, it has this smoky smell that's instantly recognizable. And these were all home tanned, which is really a dying process up north, because, well, we won't get into that. But anyway, this wonderful fragrance of the smoke would come up the stairs. And so mom was taking orders for moccasins and mukluks by a person would draw their foot out on a piece of paper. My mom would give that piece of paper to one of the indigenous women. They would make the product. You know, there was a whole, like, and they would trade it for, they would often get money for it, or they were happy to get traded for fabric so that they could, you know, and it was just a really wonderful symbiotic relationship. Mm-hmm. And in the process, I got to love these women and really admire and respect them. And it was the beginning of my, of a sense of purpose that I had in my life to be an ally to Indigenous people.
I wanted to talk to you about the Sewing Circle project a little bit, but before I get to that, maybe you can go back. But I'm just so amazed by the story that you told me about the La Parka and how it came to be. And so you've always produced your product in Canada. Is that
yes?
That's something that you believed in, that you never wanted to go overseas and do any overseas production. You kept it all in Canada, and you also had your own factory at one point in Toronto that you.
Yes, I do have to say though, Glynis, that there was a period of 2 years when I was making a whole concept wardrobe. So by then, I had educated the buyers to the idea that you could have a La Parka with a matching sweater, with a matching boot, with a matching turtleneck, with a matching, you know what I mean? Like, so if there was a La Parka in a color called Opal Ice, there was a whole family of products that went with it. And one of those products was sweaters. And at the time, it was very difficult to find sweater manufacturers in Canada. I had one that was in Kitchener who did a very good job, but I wanted to do these curling sweaters that had all these, you know, designs and everything on them. And so somebody said, well, you got to go to China, got to go to Hong Kong. So for 2 years I was manufacturing my sweaters in Hong Kong. And I ran into what a lot of companies now and back then were running into, which is in that business, there's minimums required. You can't just go and order 23 of that sweater. You have to order 123 of that sweater. You have to pay up front before, with a letter of credit, before you've even seen the product. There were all kinds of contributing factors that led to me feeling a sense of loss of control. And I would say 75% of the shipments arrived exactly as I thought they would. Great quality, exactly as I had designed them, but more quantity than I actually had sales for example. So I'm left with inventory, which I had to clear. And the 25% that didn't arrive as I wanted it to, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. I just said, no, I can't do this. This is too, if I'm going to screw up, I want to be the person that screws up here in Canada. I don't want my reputation affected when somebody makes an error halfway around the world. And by that time, I've got a young family. I have small children. I didn't want to be traveling because a lot of people that do manufacture offshore, they're traveling there all the time. So that's when I recommitted to Made in Canada. And I said, okay, everybody's going offshore. Everybody's swimming downstream. And I was like the little fish that was swimming upstream saying, if we can't make it in Canada, then maybe we shouldn't be making it. And so my entire company was based on designing things that could be made in Canada rather than designing things that had to be made somewhere else.
And so is that when you decide to open your own lean manufacturing facility?
No. I didn't actually open a lean manufacturing facility. What happened was at the beginning of my company, I was using contractors for the production of my things. And they were contractors in Toronto. And what started happening was the same thing. 75% would be perfect and 25% would not. And we'd have to either recut or correct or whatever. And I just went, no, I've got to be more in control of my own. I ought to be able to walk over to something that's being made and identify if it's being made properly. And if it's not, then to stop and fix it before it's all finished. So I had my own sewing machine operators. And when my contractors started not being able to fulfill the quality that I wanted, I began to buy machines, but not all at once, buy sewing machines, hire sewing machine operators. And gradually I brought my production in-house, but I was still using a batch bundle system of manufacturing, which means that, you cut all the size eights and you bundle all the size eights, and then you cut all the size tens and you bundle all the size tens, and then you move the bundles to the first operation and they do all of the serging on the whatever, and then they bundle it back up and move it over to the, that's batch manufacturing. And I was using that method. In 1999, I think it was, 1999, we hired a consultant to help us to be better at delivering product to the customer when they wanted it and decrease our turnaround time. Because using the bundle method, there's a lot of time when those garments are sitting in a bundle waiting for the next operation. Right?
Yeah, and there's so a lot of work in progress.
Exactly.
Happening.
How do we eliminate? Yes. How do we eliminate that wait time? How do we eliminate waste, basically? And so for a period of about 3 months, we worked with this consultant and learned about lean manufacturing. And we converted the existing batch manufacturing factory into a lean manufacturing factory. And it was met with a fair amount of resistance by the employees, not so much the employees who were sewing machine operators, but by the middle management, because what it did was lean manufacturing empowers the person who's doing the work. So the actual sewing machine operator was empowered to make decisions that would improve the turnaround time, the flow.
Right.
And it took away the sort of power, I guess, of the middle managers. And so what happened was the sewing machine operators began to take ownership for improving our turnaround time. And it became like a really exciting and fun atmosphere because, you know, it involved, I don't need to get into detail about what lean manufacturing is, but it goes from bundling and batching to single unit production. So instead of cutting all the size eights that we need for all the customers in all of North America at one time, we would only cut the size eights for the customers that wanted that style and that color early. So instead of cutting something once, we might cut it 10 times. But that was okay because we had computerized cutting machines. Their capacity, we hadn't even reached the maximum capacity that they were capable of, but we had a constraint in our sewing. So by slowing down the cutting, we went from batch manufacturing to single unit production. So one garment would start being made, and we put the machines in the order in which the operations had to be made, so that garment would be finished in 7 minutes. So it went from a cut garment to being shippable in 7 minutes, as opposed to having 100 garments, 20% made, that weren't going to be shippable for another 3 weeks. So it was so exciting, honestly.
Wow.
It was so exciting because we started seeing real improvements in the way our customers were, because we had a whole merchandise concept. Some customers only wanted to do two colors of La Parka and all the things that went with it. It didn't matter to them that somebody in Oklahoma wanted these other two colors. So, but they didn't want theirs until later. So what it meant was, let's make these guys first, get them out, and then we'll go and focus on this order over here. And so our customers were happier. Our employees were happier. We reduced our management staff and increased our sewing staff.
Wow. So improved the overall efficiency of everything.
We don't use the word efficiency, because efficiency applies to batch manufacturing. So it's very efficient to take a bundle of 100 garments and surge everything.
Yeah.
And then bundle it. That's efficiency, right? If you take it in isolation. In lean manufacturing, we refer to productivity.
Okay, productivity.
Yes, versus efficiency, because you can be efficient but not productive. You know what I mean? It's like when you go to Costco and you buy enough kiwi fruit to last you for a month. That's very efficient. But it's not very productive when you have to throw half of it out because it goes bad in your fridge.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, because I think, you know, this lean manufacturing is being more adopted into production now. I'm seeing it more, but the bundling system is still the most common way that they do production, especially if it's overseas. Majority is the bundling system, but very rarely do people, you know, go into the lean manufacturing. So you are just really like ahead of your time in
absolutely. And we've always been ahead of our time. I've always been ahead of my time in terms of embracing technology. When we were only doing like $1 million in sales, I brought in Electra being the company from France that produces the best CAD/CAM systems. I brought in Electra pattern making, pattern grading. So back in the 80s, I had computerized pattern making. And I was, I think I was the first company in Toronto that had that. Even though we were a relatively small company, I didn't see, like, people think, oh, you know, computerized, you have to be a big company. No, you don't. In our case, it enabled us to become a big company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is really ahead of the time, because I don't know that many people, even when I started in the industry in the 90s, that who were using computerized pattern making. It was still very manual. I worked at Clamonico actually.
Oh yeah.
Was my first job. They were on King and Spadina. That's where the head office was based, and they did their manufacturing on King Street. And they was, well, they when they still did the production locally in Canada, but a lot of the pattern making was still done like manually. And this was like late 90s, so but you doing this in the 80s, seriously, that is like, this is amazing. So would you say a lot of this force, like the foresight, like from hearing your story now of, you having the vision of La Parka, seeing the truck, after you felt so much doubt, and then making kind of, okay, this is the sign to move ahead. And then, being ahead of, staying ahead of technology, and implementing the lean manufacturing and all the technology and stuff, like, would you say like all of this contributed to your overall success and your longevity in the industry?
Well, yeah, but there's another part to this story, Glynis.
Oh.
There's another part to this story. It gets even better. So where am I now? Well, guess what? I'm going to pick up the phone. I'm making paper patterns in my studio. I do not have computerized pattern making equipment. I've gone back to the
Gone.
way I was working in 1974 in that two-bedroom apartment. And my life has come full circle.
Circle.
I started in a two-bedroom apartment and I'm now in a two-bedroom house with a studio in the upstairs. But I built a multi-million dollar company. At one point we were doing over $13 million in sales. I realized I set out when I was at Sheridan College, I envisioned having someday having a state-of-the-art manufacturing facility. I didn't know about lean back then, but I created everything together with a community of people that came, found me, and helped me. I had a wonderful team of people that joined me on that journey, including my husband Joel, who was a chartered accountant, and he came in right at the point where the numbers were starting to get bigger, and I needed somebody I could trust managing the money. Right around to 2008, when for the first time in 2007, for the first time, I had a decline in sales. And in 2008, the bank called my loan and gave us 30 days to pay back $3 million.
Oh.
Yeah.
So what did you
Now,
do?
I don't know. I don't know if you remember what happened in 2008.
Yeah, well, that was the time of the recession, right?
There was a world financial
The
crisis. Yeah.
economy tanked, the
Yeah.
world financial
Yeah.
crisis in New York, and
World financial crisis. And a lot of Canadian banks were involved in the whole fiasco happening south of the border with subprime mortgages and all that sort of stuff. Somebody in a suit in an office on Bay Street at my bank decided that we were off margin with our loan, and we were often off margin with our loan because we had a cyclical business. We were a seasonal business, so there were times when we were over our credit limit and times when the bank owed us money. So it was and the bank rock and rolled with us through those highs and lows. Well, somebody decided, okay, we're being put under pressure here. We better call in any loans that are off margin. So the bank called our loan. I'm now, my girls are teenagers. I'm now in my 50s. I've been working hard my whole life, focused. I didn't have a plan B. I never had a plan B. I never had a plan that, well, if this company in this two-bedroom apartment doesn't work, I'll do this. If this company in this state-of-the-art manufacturer, I never had a plan B. So for the first time in my whole career, I started thinking about what my plan B would be if I had one. And my husband and I looked at one another and we said, I don't think we can do this anymore. I don't think we want to borrow more money to pay off the bank, owe somebody else money, put everything we have on the line and risk it all again. And you know what? It was a good decision, because in January of 2008, when the bank called our loan, was the beginning of the financial crisis. It got worse. And so it became a bloodbath. And so we ended up paying back the bank in 30 days, believe it or not. We just put our heads down and we said, okay, everything's for sale. We're gonna liquidate. Anything that's not nailed down, we're gonna sell it. And we ended up paying back the bank, which gave us a little bit of breathing room and enough time to find a buyer. And we found a buyer and sold the company in 2008. And in 2010, we left Toronto and moved to our cottage. And that's where I'm speaking to you from today.
Wow, what a story. Oh my God.
Yeah. So one of my speeches, I'm a speaker, and one of my topics is the F word. And the F word is how to ride that wild bronco that's failure.
Yeah.
And now, you know, I live on a lake, surrounded by beautiful cedar trees. My husband and I are together. My girls are good. And I have this little studio that's about the same size as that. No, it's smaller than the two-bedroom apartment that I had on in 1974. And I have paper patterns. And I'm having a ball. You know, my joy still comes from making things. And so in this little studio, we use lean manufacturing. We don't have digital patterns, but we do have single unit production.
And is this where you make all your Thermakota products?
Yes.
And so now you're in this studio, kind of made full circle, kind of sort of where you started with your first industrial sewing machine, still there working away.
Yes, and I have other machines too.
You have their machines and you're doing paper patterns, and you are working with your daughters, which you have co-founded this new company with.
Yes.
So
my one daughter lives in Los Angeles and my other daughter lives in Ireland. And when we began Thermakota in 2016, we were working remotely with each other. So when COVID hit, it was no big deal. It was the same way we'd been working for 4 years.
Yeah.
You know, I'm here in my studio and we have FaceTime and we have, you know, we talk every day, and they're responsible for the front end, which is, you know, the photography, the website, the image of the brand. Sophie is also a wonderful model. And Moshe is more director of marketing, which is, you know, positioning the brand as a, you know, a premium brand of mostly shearling. Mm-hmm. So if you go to thermakota.com, you'll see the shearling styles that we make. And shearling, by its very nature, has to be cut one at a time. And so one of the unique aspects of Thermakota is that we offer our customers at no extra charge a custom made garment. So they give us their measurements, and I often have to call the customer just to verify the measurement, because I'm thinking, you know, somebody 5'8" could not have a sleeve that short. So I call them and say, I think maybe we needed a better sleeve measurement. And so it gives us a chance to really interact with the customer. And then we go ahead and make about 75% of our orders, I would say maybe 80, are custom. Mm-hmm. And we've only had two instances where we had returns, and they were both from men. We do make a men's product as well, And the men made a little error in their measurements. And so I had to but we've only had two returns, and we've made hundreds of shearling jackets.
And everything, you are strictly online with this business, right?
Strictly online. And I said to my daughter, when she said, "Mom, I think we should get into the outerwear business." And I said, "Well," she said, "we could sell at Barney's, we could sell at Lord & Taylor, we could sell." I said, "No." I was in the retail, I was in the wholesale business, selling to boutiques for 34 years. I don't want to do that. I don't want to do it again. I've done that. So we decided to focus on online, and, you know, people place their orders, they pay for their orders. Oh. We ship their orders. It's a very clean
to order, no extra inventory, business. No
exactly.
Excess production.
Exactly.
And I know that you have a philosophy, going back to your mother, you have a motto, it's waste not, want not.
Yeah.
I saw that. And, you know, do you want to speak a little bit about that and how that applies in your business, Thermacoda now, and how you guys approach, you know, sustainability?
It's a philosophy of life, mm-hmm. Glynis. It's the way I look at life. I don't want to waste anything. You know, I even this morning, I knew I was going to be speaking with you, and I decided to sleep in. I decided to just let myself have a nice long sleep, because I didn't want to waste that precious time where I could do that, you know, where I didn't have something that had to be, you know, had to be done. So I was taking advantage of that. But it waste not, want not. I mean, when we lived up in, you know, the mining communities up north, I don't remember us ever having garbage. All the food waste went into the garden. I design everything according to the material that I'm using.
Okay.
And a lot of times, when I was teaching at George Brown College, my students tended to do it the other way around. They'd be sketching all these designs, and then they'd go out and try and find fabric that would suit the designs. And it was quite often a miss, because they had the design was might have been good, the fabric might have been great, but they didn't go together. So I feel it's really important to let the material you're using speak to you about what to make out of it.
So just before we wrap up, well, I had a couple questions left. First of all, about you'd spoke about you finding a sense of purpose, which was becoming an ally of the First Nations, and that's the reason why. Is that reason why you started the Sewing Circle project?
Or? Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Now the Sewing Circle is really an intention that I have to support Indigenous communities to be able to make, to be more clothing independent and be able to make things in their community by their community members, and for the appreciation of people visiting their communities. Or, you know, for example, right now I'm working with a group, Georgian Bay, the First Nation on Christian Island, and we're going to be starting a sewing circle there. Sometimes the sewing circle is just me sourcing fabric or supplies for a community and arranging for shipment to that community, because they may not know who to go to for a particular fabric or whatever. And because I have a network of suppliers that I, from my business, so I can connect, you know, the supplier with the community. And quite often I'm an intermediary for sourcing supplies. So for example, I've had fabric shipped to Pond Inlet, which is a northern point of Baffin Island. I've sourced machinery, in that case, machinery and fabric. I've sent fabric to Deer Lake, which is one of the communities north of Red Lake, Maskwacis in Alberta. So Piawanik, Moose Factory. Sometimes all I'm providing is supplies. I'm an intermediary. I source things, and I don't charge a markup for that. It's just something that I love to do. The work that I'm doing with the Georgian Bay community is I'm they want to have a store and a workshop where they actually can make things to sell to tourists that are indigenous to that area and to those people of that First Nation. And so I'm going to help them understand how to make patterns, how to do lean manufacturing, and make sure it set them up with the proper connections to suppliers.
Sounds like a wonderful initiative.
Yeah, it's a bit, it started out as one thing, and then it kind of took on a life of its own, and it's become sort of a variety of different services, but it's all intended to support Indigenous, the talent that lies within Indigenous communities that just needs to have access to the right materials at the right prices, you know?
Mm-hmm. Amazing. So last question for aspiring fashion designers and entrepreneurs listening to this podcast, what piece of advice would you like to share based on your experiences in the industry?
Start lifting weights. Make sure you're physically fit. People don't think of fashion designers as being, you know, having to be physically fit, but it's really important because it's a very physically demanding job. It's not just sketching. It's lifting rolls of fabric, and quite often they're full rolls of fabric, which is pretty bloody heavy.
Yeah. So in the beginning, like in most cases, just like yourself, you know, you had to do everything, right?
That's right.
And that included heavy lifting, carrying bolts of fabric, right?
That's
back
right.
And forth, you know, from and, the whole warehouse yeah,
and
to
you
the
look,
factory.
You look around and you go, well, there's no muscular man standing there. People underestimate how physically fit you need to be in this business. You don't know what's going to come at you. Even lifting finished garments for a fashion show and carrying them, you know.
Oh, no kidding, right?
Schlepping garments around.
Schlepping garments around in garment bags.
That's my one piece of advice. My other piece of advice is to find a purpose and a path that is unique to you that you can offer to the world. And that might not come to you right away, but always be looking for what that could be for you. For me, it really started when I said, what can I make that's as Canadian, you know, as a kimono is Japanese? And that's when I started to really develop my identity as a designer. So who you are, where you come from, what your family is all about, what culture did you grow up in? What is your perception of fashion and how does it fit into what you want to do? You know, I see, it's one of the questions I have about when I see, a designer who's clearly not a sample size and is sending models down the runway that are, you know, size 2. And yet when that designer walks out on the runway, they're not size 2 or anywhere close to size 2. And I'm thinking, wow, it'd be so great if you were designing for people your size, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's some kind of a disconnect there for me. It's so much easier if you can just, so as a result, I'm not a small person myself. I'm 5'9" and I'm a good size 14, 12, 14. And my fit became popular within the population that was my size because they knew that my things would fit them. And when, and people would come to me and say, oh, your things, I'm so tiny. I'm so tiny. And I go, yeah, well, there are tiny designers that would make things that would be perfect for you, you know? And it doesn't mean to say that, like, I have lots of customers that are 5'1", 5'2". It doesn't mean that I've excluded anybody. It just means that I'm starting from a point of familiarity for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good point. And I think that's what contributed to your longevity and probably still what keeps you going is that you are designing in terms of it from a point of place of alignment. That's what I see.
Yeah, that's it. That's it, Gilinas.
That's kind of the, I feel this theme that's carrying through out this conversation that I'm having is that I'm seeing from what I'm hearing you say, you know?
Yeah. And you have to be aware of the signs and signals that the universe is sending. I know this sounds like makes sound like a wingnut, but you, I really, I'm proof that if you pay attention to the signs and signals that the universe is sending you, that you will, if you pay attention to the signs and signals that the universe sends you on your path that are meant to direct you in a certain way, believe, have faith that if you follow that path, it will take you somewhere good.
Oh, I love that. Thank you so much, Linda.
And even going bankrupt, having my company, fail in 2008, even that was a gift. And the second thing, besides, being physically strong, that I want to share with people as a piece of advice is that I've gone through life believing that everything is a gift. Everything is a gift. Growing up in the bush turned out to be a gift. Losing my company in 2008 became a gift because now I live on a lake surrounded by cedar trees and I'm working in my studio and I'm still doing what I love. So losing my company was a gift because I would have been in worse shape if I'd clung on to it and not listened to what the universe was telling me. So everything in life, in business, is a gift. And if you have that belief, then you will find that no matter what happens, you can survive it, you can thrive, and be happy.
Amazing. I mean, from someone who's been through it all and has,
That's right.
been the through the ups and downs. Where can people find you if they want to get in touch with you? You're on TikTok. Your
I'm on
TikTok
TikTok.
handle.
I'm on
You're on
Instagram.
Instagram.
Follow me
Yeah.
on TikTok at LifeHacksLinda.
Yeah.
They can follow me on Instagram. On Instagram, I think I'm Lundstrom Linda, and those are my two main platforms. And I don't participate that much on Facebook, although I do have somebody that is posting for me on Facebook from time to time. And
Perfect.
then if you go to thermacoda.com, it's
Yes.
possible to get a message to me through that.
Okay, amazing. Thank you so much for being here
Okay.
today and sharing your insight and knowledge about the fashion industry with us. Thank you so much for tuning in. You can find me on Instagram at Glynis Tao and my website, glynistao.com. Please subscribe to Chase Your Dreams podcast if you haven't already. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others who you think this may help. And lastly, it would be great if you left a rating and review for our podcast. See you next time.